So if we could go ahead and get started, we have quorum. Rick, can we have it reflect that we came to order at 3:04?
Yes.
The first item on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. Are there any changes? None. Seeing none, the agenda is approved. The next item on our agenda is approval of the November 26, 2019 meeting minutes. Are there any changes? Not the meeting minutes from the November 26th meeting are approved. The next item on our agenda is the provost report.
So, I'm a blank screen. Hey, there we go. All right, thank you. So thank you, everyone, and welcome to a new term and a whole new year. It's pretty exciting. I thought I'd have some slides this time. There's only three, so not too many of them that I can just talk through. I'm happy to take questions as we go along or at the end. I really want to touch on two things. One is budget, and that'll touch a little bit on the legislative session, which is going on. And then the second is the strategic planning process that the president announced in her State of the University address. I almost said State of the Union.
If only.
Yeah, right. The State of the University address, and so I'll talk a little bit about that, too. In terms of where we are in the budget process, budget leadership team has been meeting for quite some time during the academic year to do a number of things, and we've talked about some of those things, decide what to do about budget shortfalls for this year, which we decided to cover with the remaining central reserves that exist, and I'll talk about the slide in a second. So we avoided a budget rescission during the middle of this year, and that's I think we're feeling pretty good about that now that we've seen the enrollment numbers for this term, and so I think we're okay with that. And then we've been planning for budgets for next year, looking at potential revenues from tuition, which expect to be down because of enrollment shortfalls, and revenues from the state. And so those two together are our main budgetary drivers, of course. And so knowing what the state's going to do is pretty important to us. The HED came out with a set of recommendations. Those were very generous, actually. They were very largely driven by the Council of University Presidents recommendations, which argued for fairly substantial increases to higher education, particularly for the comprehensive universities, the 4 years. But those got baked down into the governor's recommendation, the executive recommendation, and the legislative recommendation from the LFC. This is a summary of those two recommendations. And so from the governor for main campus, for ING increase is about 1.2%, a little over $2 million. For HSC, 1.5%, just under $1 million. And this is just ING. There are other sources of funds for some of these units, of course. Gallup, $500 increase is proposed. That rounds out to 0%. Los Alamos, 2.2%, about $40,000. Taos, 4.1%, $150,000. Valencia, 2.5%, as you see there. These are relatively higher percentages because this is only their ING budget for the branch campuses. They get substantial funds at the branch campuses, of course, from their local millages. And so these small amounts sometimes translate into larger percentage increases. We have a number of RPSPs before the legislature. I'm reporting only on the increases. Our continuing ones continue as expected. For main campus, about $200,000. That's to support the Grow Your Own Teacher network. And again, this is just the recommendation from the executive. This is not what's happening. And HSC, about $2.6 million. Legislative recommendations, somewhat more generous, somewhat surprisingly. Usually the LFC is a little more conservative, but they recommended about 3% increase for main campus, 2.5% for HSC, 1% for Gallup, 3%, Los Alamos, 5%, almost 6% for Taos, 3.9 for Valencia. They recommend additional RPS fees, so 500,000 there, and a little less at HSC, 1.3 million. The executive is recommending a 2% increase for public employees, and so a 2% increase for the university, with that funding provided in a way that would fund about 88% of our salaries. In previous years, a recommendation of funding from the state funded about half of our salaries. So if they said 2% increase, they gave us enough for a 1%, and the rest is up to us. So this year, executives are recommending 2%, and that's funded at about 88%. And the LFC is recommending 3%, funded at about 70%. The Council of University Presidents request, and this year was a 5% compensation increase, so just to get a sense of where these land relative to that. I should say that both the executive and the legislative recommendations include a $35 million recommendation that's around mostly student support and scholarship, but deployed in very different ways. For the executive side, that's recommended as $35 million for the Opportunity Scholarship. For the legislative recommendation, a chunk of that is, I may misremember the number, about $5 million recurring to support low-income students. There's a recommended tranche of funds one time to increase the lottery scholarship for the short term, not the long term, and then a few other specific recommendations. And so there's a lot for the legislature and the governor to rectify between their two sets of recommendations for higher ed, including around that $35 million that both have set aside mostly as one-time funds for scholarships. We don't know really, but we speculate that the when you look around the state appropriations, most state departments and divisions are being recommended for higher increases than these kind of 1%, 1.5, 2%, 3%. We think the difference is that the state is looking at that $35 million, or at least the governor is looking at the $35 million and saying, that's another tranche of funds for higher ed. And so that may be why these numbers look lower compared to other state institutions. That doesn't really help us very much because the $35 million to us, the Opportunity Scholarship or the Lottery Scholarship, that is not new money. That just displaces tuition. So that does not, in fact, bring new funding into the university. It's very helpful for students, but not for the institution directly. It's helpful for us if the number of students increases and in indirect ways. That's a bit of speculation on our part about why these numbers are kind of low compared to what's recommended for other units. Because of where these numbers are, one, it's a little hard to plan budgets. That's a fairly big range, 2.3 million to 5.6 million, 2% compensation funded at 88% or 3% funded at 70%. It's a little hard to plan. There's an awful lot of work going on up in Santa Fe right now. From our perspective, to increase these, to move closer to the Council of University President recommendations, and frankly, closer to the HED recommendations. And there's an awful lot of work, of course, going on between the legislative and executive branch to rectify those as well. So we don't know where this is going to land, really. But we've got a sense of where things are. And because of that sense, what we expect is that we will have to do significant recurring budget reductions in next year's budget. That's not unexpected. It's what I talked to you guys about when I last talked about budget. We didn't do a midterm rescission because we were instead have to kind of really take the bull by the horns and adjust our recurring budget to what our income streams can actually support. We don't know what number that is yet, because it depends a lot on that 1.2 versus 2.9 versus potentially something closer to the HED and other recommendations. But orders of magnitude, it's going to be something like 10 million, 12 million, 13 million that we remove from the recurring budget, because it doesn't exist. So just to get a sense of where we are. That is not, that's not good news. It's not something that is new in terms of what we can manage as an institution. We would much rather it weren't there. But that's kind of where we are right now. A lot will depend on enrollment and how quickly enrollment growth turns around. We are seeing it turn around, but because we have smaller classes already, we're going to see decreased enrollments for the next year or two in any event. And so we do know that we're, over the next month or so, working to build a budget that's smaller than our current budget. Okay, so at the same time as that's going on, that doesn't mean we want to stop doing new things. It doesn't mean we don't have important needs. We did a five-year budget planning exercise with all of the schools and colleges, and we said, plan for 5 years. What do you anticipate in terms of faculty growth, in terms of students? What are your highest priorities as you look out over 5 years? What does that mean in terms of the resources that you need? Just from academic affairs, the schools and colleges, that generated 207 requests for funding, recurring funding, totaling about $90 million over 5 years. So good news, we do not lack ambition. That's a good thing. None of those requests were bad. They were all good ideas. And so we have a lot of needs. It's not news. But it's good to have them kind of all written down, documented. We can keep going back to this over the next few years to say we need this, we need this. We have a five-year vision of what we need. We're not going year to year. Those requests are being prioritized. We've shown a bunch of them to the budget leadership team. We're giving them a kind of a list of them and saying, how would you prioritize these to help advise the process? But here are some of them. And I'm only showing you the items that are over $100,000. There's a whole bunch of things that are smaller, but they wouldn't fit on the slide. They'd be down there. So I'm just trying to show you kind of a sense of some of the big items. Faculty promotions. Faculty are going to be promoted. As they're promoted, their salaries go up, so we have to fund that. And I'm indicating some of these are for specific units. That's over 10 schools. This, by the way, is all main campus stuff. It's not including HSC or the HSC academic events. New dean funding. We have four new deans coming in fine arts, architecture and planning, Anderson School, and education. Some of those schools don't actually even have the dean's line funded, so we need to fund some dean lines. And, of course, deans coming in are going to say things like, well, I'd love to be dean at the School of Education at College of Education at UNM. Can I have a faculty member? And so we're anticipating those kinds of things. So that 720 or so is new dean funding that'll go out to those four schools as new deans come in. Or not. That'll depend a little bit on this is funding subject to negotiation with those individual deans. Enrollment management had about 500,000 in requests for the next academic year, recurring, of which we prioritized some at about 260,000. These are mostly for people doing recruiting, financial aid management for students, things like that. Innovation Academy, which some of you know, it's a very successful program that we've been running for the last several years. A lot of students engaged, and it has actually no source of funding. It is funded through grants, gifts, one-time funds. It's about a $300,000 a year operation. The proposal is to give them at least a base on which to build. I actually believe an entrepreneurship program should never be fully funded. They have to be out there beating the bushes for funding. It's part of what entrepreneurship's about. But it's really hard to have nothing. And so base funding for that. Counseling support of various kinds. Law school has needs. Shack has needs. There's separate requests for counseling, by the way, from athletics that we're actually trying to fund through the legislature right now as well. By the way, removed from this things we're trying to fund through the legislature through direct asks of various kinds. And these are all recurring, not one-time funds. student success initiatives, and so we want to have some funding around to support some of the peer tutoring programs, some of the peer tutoring programs that we've lost that have had to go away over the last few years, to run a competition for faculty design student success initiatives. So we want to set aside some funds for that. Provost contingency, and so the provost currently has no contingency. And so when folks come to me and ask for funds, we find them, but at the moment we're kind of like, no place for that to come from. And so over what we've done actually is we had a $250K contingency, and over the years what we've done is handed out as recurring funds. So someone college needed to retain a faculty member, we handed it out to the college and said, here, use this to retain that faculty member. So we basically distributed those existing contingency funds to schools and colleges. Athletics is asking for equipment for the football team, as well as cost of attendance scholarships.
Could I interrupt?
Yeah.
Why would football equipment come from academic affairs?
This is everything. This is not. Oh, I'm sorry. The first lines is about what we received, but the two charts are everything. So the two charts are meant to give you a picture of all of the requests that are coming in for recurring funding, not just academic affairs.
That wouldn't come from academic affairs, though, right? Okay.
Those happen to have come from academic affairs. These are from athletics.
That's what I thought.
And there'll be a bunch over there from other units as
well. Thank you for the clarification.
Sorry about that. Yeah, so I was only describing up top what academic affairs received, but the two charts are to give you a sense of the larger requests from the entirety of the university outside HSC. University Council sees a need for some for new hires, both paralegals and attorneys, so there's a request there. OUC also contracts a fair bit for outside legal services, $250,000 a year, and there's no funds set aside for that, so what we do right now is University Council goes to Teresa Constantinidis and says, you have some money somewhere? And so rather than doing that, we're spending it anyway. Let's just put it aside. So in a sense, it's not a new request. It's to sort of shift some funds that already exist. And it's blank because there's some. When I created this slide, there was some uncertainty as to what's the number. It's 250. OUC has a need for some folks in compliance, so they're requesting funds there. It's a series of requests from University Communications. Most of them focused on growing enrollment and making the university visible. And so you see those there. I won't read them all. And then finally, the Vice President for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion kind of has an unfunded office. And so there's some funding there, but really it's pretty minimal. And so it's a request for support for the senior diversity staff in the schools and colleges, the various associate deans and others who are doing diversity work, and then DEI staff as well. So those are kind of just, again, the big requests, all of the university, excluding HSC, just so you kind of get a sense of what those requests are. And again, the recurring requests, not the one time, not capital or anything. Okay, so that's where we are on budget. Over the next 2 or 3 weeks, hopefully as information clarifies from the roundhouse, we will start to actually put a budget together. Again, there's a somewhat longer list of these. We're asking the BLT to prioritize so we get some input on how they see sort of ranking those. I will tell you that in academic affairs, as we looked at requests, we looked at student success, we looked at faculty success, we looked at requests that spanned multiple schools and colleges. Those were kind of some of the criteria we used as saying these are the things we want to do, and we looked at enrollment. Those were kind of the four most important things for us as we looked at requests. Okay, I'm going to stop and pause because the next slide has nothing to do with budget. It does have to do with resources, but not budget. So see if there are any other questions, comments.
I have a question. No. Sorry. I always have a question. $10 to $12 million in permanent cuts is the largest I've seen in a long time looking at these. Where are we looking to make those cuts? Because we're not showing that here.
Yeah, and two comments. It's actually, in some ways, it's not the largest. What we've tended to do is do a mid-year rescission and then do a cut. And so we've actually been doing larger cuts than it seems. We've just been doing them in slices. Mm-hmm. It is still not an insignificant cut. Mm-hmm. And so it is a significant cut. And what we're doing is looking at, that's ING. So what we're doing is looking at units that have ING funding, distributing that across kind of the top level. So the president's operations, facilities and administration, finance administration, and academic affairs. And then within each of those units, the appropriate folks are deciding how do we distribute it within. Within academic affairs, we're looking at provost units, that is sort of, you know, the things that directly report to the provost that are not schools and colleges. And we'll look at distributing those cuts a little more strategically. Some we've actually already done. We've done some reallocations. And then we talked last time I talked about budget, we actually talked about models of distributing those cuts to schools and colleges based on factors like enrollments, student credit hours, degrees, and so on. The model we're settling on looks at student credit hours taught, and it looks at growth in enrollment. So units that are growing get a smaller reduction than units that are not growing. And so there's kind of a binary switch there. Units that have that are doing less in terms of student teaching and engagement take a cut, and units that are seeing growth simply don't take a cut based on that factor.
Right.
So we're trying to sort of distribute between both overall activity and is there growth, because we don't want to stifle that growth or harm a unit that's having increased numbers of students involved. A lot depends on how much there's cut. Now, $12 million sounds like a lot, but the thing I keep saying to the deans especially, just because there's a $12 million reduction in budget doesn't mean we have to do $12 million less work next year. Because we have $40 million in reserves spread across the university.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sit in a central pot. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the schools and colleges to a large extent.
They're usually held for hires and things, right?
Held for all kinds of things. What that allows a unit to do is not, whatever the reduction is not to simply chop it off in one year, but actually say, okay, well, we'll backfill part of that with reserves. And next year we might backfill a little less. And at the same time, hopefully, enrollments go up so that we can, in fact, a unit with reserves never had to take that cliff. And that's how I would manage it. If I were sitting in the dean's chair for a particular unit, if I had those reserves, I'd use it in those ways. That's the way that we would have managed a midterm rescission.
Mm-hmm.
We would have done a midterm rescission. Units would have backfilled it with reserves. Right? And so it's important to remember when we think about a $12 million cut, it doesn't mean that it all happens at once, even though it's removed from the budget, because there are actually considerable reserves. They're just distributed.
And do we ever look to athletics for cuts when academics is always... I mean, everything I hear is academics. It just feels like, shouldn't we be looking to the other side of the house?
Well, so that wouldn't actually do us any good, because the ING funding for academics
right,
is basically
good point.
Nothing.
Yeah, good point.
So it's the wrong
unless we
money.
Are subsidizing them, which we do.
Not with large amounts of ING funding.
Okay.
And so there's very little ING funding to pull out of athletics.
Okay, thanks.
There's funding there,
yeah,
but
there
it comes from other sources.
Yeah.
That's why their primary source of funding is happening right now. It's Eddie Nunez roaming around the roundhouse asking legislators for individual asks.
He has a question.
Provost.
Provost.
Yes.
Tuition. So if I remember from the PLT, from what I've heard, there was a proposal to perhaps result in a kind of tuition increase that the deal with the trough funding situation with credits?
Yeah, I should have put a slide in about that. So the proposal from the Tuition and Fee Committee is to increase tuition kind of overall, increase base tuition at basically the Higher Education Price Index. And for those of you who haven't seen it, the Higher Education Price Index is an inflationary index for higher ed. It's different from the Consumer Price Index because the Consumer Price Index is about the growth in the cost of a loaf of bread. And the cost, the rate of growth of industries, businesses, universities that are reliant on people more, orchestras, is higher than the inflation of a loaf of bread. So that's leading to a recommendation of a base tuition increase of about 2.6. But in addition to that, the university has what we tend to call the trough. We give students who are between 15 and 18 credit hours a significant discount. So a student who's between 15 and 18 credit hours, we give a discount of about $850, something like that. And so the other recommendation from the Tuition Fees Committee is to reduce that discount to about $400, not to eliminate it entirely, but to reduce it. And so that's another source of revenue and funds for the institution if we adopt those recommendations. Right? Those are recommendations. We're hearing feedback on them. The concern with the trough, getting rid of the trough makes sense. It was put in place in a different time for a particular purpose. We no longer need it as a tool. It was a way to help ensure that students took 15 to 18 credit hours so they'd be more likely to graduate within 4 years. There are other incentives for students to do that now. And so we don't need it as much for that purpose, but we're still doing that discount. We're still discounting students in kind of that sweet full-time spot. So reducing the discount has merit. Reducing that discount and increasing the base tuition actually results in a fairly significant increase in tuition for students in that 15 to 18 credit hour range. It's not quite, it's on the order of 10%. It's not 10%, whatever it is. So that's a fairly big jump. And so I have concerns about that. The students on the Tuition and Fees Committee have endorsed that. They think it's okay. But I think we still need to do some thinking about that because it is a fairly big jump. And should we phase it in? They already discussed that and decided not to do it. But I think we'll have to talk about it. And in the end, that's a Regents decision.
Right. And have you taken their pulse yet? Because they're very anti.
Yeah. And it's not clear to me that would actually fly with them. Yeah. Although the thing is, it's really a 2.9% increase and the elimination of a discount. What we currently do is discount.
Well, sure.
We give students a gift.
And is it true that our tuition really is less than New Mexico State?
I think it is.
They went up.
Yeah.
Like
this
6%
year
or something. Yeah, no. Incredible amounts.
We're not overpriced by any means.
No, we're not.
But a sudden change in tuition is a big deal. And so I think that's a legitimate concern that we really need to think before committing. There's a set of other recommendations around tuition I'll mention, particularly at the graduate level. If folks are interested, we could organize a presentation about that as well. They're just recommendations at this point, but it's really, we have incredibly complex tuition structures. Our cost of attendance page it tells you the base tuition. Very few students pay the base tuition. Most students are in arts and sciences. They pay more than the base tuition. So if you actually try and figure out your tuition, you need a college degree to do it. And so there's a set of recommendations about starting to try and simplify all of that extra structure, much of which is really us exposing to students our internal accounting. Differential tuition is an accounting issue. We take some of tuition, we give it straight to the college. That's accounting. That's not something the student needs to see necessarily. And yet we kind of expose it and layer it. Yeah?
Just a question. It seems like our tuition is much less than similar public institutions in regional and adjacent states. Is that true?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
we're one of the lowest of our 22 peer institutions.
Yeah. our tuition is not too high.
No, it isn't. It's perception.
But there is an interesting question here. This is an incredibly successful research institution at access. So very few research institutions provide the level of access we do with something like 45% Pell, for example, or 40% Pell, whatever the number is. It's that order. Similar number of first-gen students. Very few research institutions can do that. And one reason for it is low sticker price. Because it's pretty well known across the higher ed now. High sticker price, high discount models, which is what most large research institutions trying to do to support access, are marginally successful because you present students with a complicated picture. Come here. Here's our high price. Oh, but for you, we'll give you a discount. It'll be okay. It's at the moment of application, of submitting, of paying $80 or whatever it is to pay the application fee, that feels like, no, I don't know if that's worth it. So there's a whole lot of work across the country to simplify tuition to make it transparent. The Opportunity Scholarship would do that in a certain sense for in-state students, so just covered. And a lot of the attempts across the country have been of that nature, not always to bring it to zero, but to bring it to a low single number for depending on your income, for example. Mm-hmm. But in any event, yes, it's absolutely true. Our tuition is low compared to appropriate peers. And so raising tuition is not crazy, but we do have to ask what it does to our mission of access, because we're pretty unique in providing access. And, of course, the Regents have some pretty strong. I think I just got the iPhone thing.
Oh.
So let me jump on briefly to strategic planning, or UNM 2040, as we're calling it. And so during her State of the University address, President Stokes announced that we'd be starting this strategic planning effort. There are a lot of details behind this. They're not all here, of course. But the purpose, of course, is to think about providing ourselves with a long-term vision of where we want to be as an institution so that we can make short-term and intermediate-term decisions about how to get there. And the decision we've made is to really think a little bit out there, 2040. And 2040 was selected because that's the decade in which every research institution has to look like us, majority-minority. And so we're already there. We are in some ways the leader of higher education. We're the institution that can help the rest of higher education figure that out. And so let's think about what we need to be in 2040 when everyone else is catching up with us. And let's think far out and aspirationally. Not because we're going to lay out a perfect path from here to 2040, but because we want to have a vision of where we want to get to. A few universities have done this, not huge numbers, but Georgia Tech did, Texas did, a number of years ago, and then just made systematic decisions to move towards that vision. So equally, we have to do some short-term stuff, and there's a whole lot of things that we ought to take a look at. And so rather than have one massive strategic planning committee and effort, we're really describing a set of parallel and aligned efforts. And so one of them will be this 2040 Vision Task Force, which is to think about what is that 2040 vision for UNM, what are our values, what's the value proposition for our mission, what is the value we bring students, what is the value we bring society and our disciplines through our intellectual work, what does the future of education look like in higher ed, what does it mean to have free tuition for the undergrad, what does it mean for the future of graduate education? What is research going to look like? What's creative production look like? What does our service mission look like? But to really look far out. And I will embarrass him. They describe the value proposition. We call that the Finney Coleman clause. Because that was Finney's point to bring to us, that, you know, we really ought to articulate what is our value to our students, what is our value to our state, what is our value to our disciplines, to all aspects of our mission. How do we bring value? There'll be a diversity and inclusion planning process starting up, but led by Asada Zarai. I think I saw Asada walking. There she is. And so that's to establish our diversity values and create a strategy for increasing both demographic diversity and improving climate. A group called The Next Big Thing. Let's explore goals for then. What is it that we should be thinking about? What are the opportunities for a significant research activity or enterprise here? And how do we lay the groundwork for that? I've had a number of faculty come to me and say, you know, we need a new center. We need something big. We need something exciting. Absolutely. But to get to something big and new and exciting, you've got to lay the groundwork for it. It doesn't just happen. So example, just as an example, the Very Large Array is down, you know, their headquarters is down in Socorro. The telescope itself is in New Mexico. The National Science Foundation is approving plans for a much larger next generation Very Large Array spanning the states of Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, and Colorado. What do we have to do to get the headquarters here and not in Socorro? And some steps have already been taken in that direction. But that's the kind of thing where can we identify those big opportunities and figure out, okay, if we want to get that, what do we have to start doing now in order to make that happen? And so that's what we'd like that group to be thinking about. What are the strengths we bring, the opportunities we bring, but let's identify the steps to get there. Because it's never a matter of you just get lucky and something happens. You prepare to get lucky. And so we need to be systematic about that. Securing our future is about establishing the resource base for a dynamic and growing university. So what do we need to do in terms of enrollment? How do we need to restructure our budget? How do we actually move to incentive-based budgeting plans? We're actually already doing this work. We have a draft enrollment strategic plan. We're implementing a set of steps towards more incentive-based budgeting, including distributing the benefits pool. We're bringing a proposal to BLT to distribute graduate tuition to the schools and colleges so that it will incentivize schools and colleges to build their graduate programs. Do more graduate programs, more funds flow. Without it, it just happens. And so things like that in order to make sure that we are, in fact, in 2040 still a strong and even stronger and growing place. And I want to mention a set of aligned efforts that are ongoing. The foundation is doing strategic planning. HSC is doing strategic planning. Several of the schools and colleges are going to start strategic planning. We're launching an honors task force. And so rather than sucking all of these into one big plan, we're really treating all of these as parallel efforts going on at the same time that we can coordinate and connect. So there we are. Yes?
I do have a question. I can see the reasoning behind the way this framework is set up, but my one question is, it seems to me like the conversation around diversity, equity, and inclusion is a part of all of those things. So I'm wondering what will be the interface between that dialogue and the other pillars that you have.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that up because I think it's really important. And you're right. I mean, if you think about securing our future, which includes strategic enrollment planning, that includes the diversity of that incoming student body. If you think about our vision and values, it'll be kind of strange if our vision and values don't include that very clear articulation of diversity and access. Even the way I frame this is 2040 matters because that's when everybody else has to be like us. And so each of these in their charges gets to have a piece that is about diversity. And then what we're doing actually is we'll have a strategic steering committee that includes representatives, probably the chairs of each of these groups, all of whom meet together, so that they are, in fact, strategizing with each other, stimulating each other as well. So we don't want these are kind of separate groups, we don't want them to just run in parallel. We want them to come back together and be connected. Yeah, Liz?
How do you, we've seen this kind of planning before, right? How are you setting up the membership in these committees and how to share governance fit into the project of building these plans?
Great question, because one of my asks for this group is recommendations for who should be on these various committees. We probably can't do that just by shouting out names now, but I would ask this group to really think about that, and if if there's a way to organize that, we would like to get input on who would you recommend for these various groups. Some of them are pretty natural, right? I mean, I think ASADA has some existing structures to help take on this work. Securing Our Future clearly involves Teresa Constantinidis and Dan Garcia, but clearly others. But on the other hand, that one gets pretty operational and technical. Vision is about people are really thinking about and understand the future of higher education institutions, not just higher education, but higher education, the research enterprise of higher education, the service enterprise of higher education. So I would love to have recommendations for people with the right kind of forward-looking vision to be on these various groups. Because at this point, they are mostly unformed. I'll be on the top one, I know that. Teresa and Dan are here. ASADA's got the diversity in equity and inclusion moving along. But we don't have the rest of this form. So please do share ideas who would be good folks to have on this. Yeah?
Just piggybacking off of that question, will there be a formal call for these committees with like charges and who's eligible to be on the committees?
Yes. We have not drafted the charges. We have snippets of text that will form those charges, but they're not actually written yet. Other questions, ideas?
We have a shortened agenda. We can go for a few more minutes. I wonder, does anyone else have questions about this in particular? Is this the last thing that you have for us?
I think it is.
Okay. Because I actually want to put you on the spot about another issue.
Finney, you never put me on the spot.
but I want to now. I know that there's not a whole lot that you can say about what's happening in collective bargaining and the like, but if you could give us, you know, an update from your perspective,
sure,
of where we are, kind of the timelines of where we're headed, and also, you know, the language that you shared with me about the moratorium period or the laboratory period. I think that would be useful for our senators to hear that rather than me later on kind of translating what you said.
Okay. So with respect to the collective bargaining process with UAUNM, we've had the first two of the collective bargaining sessions. They started in January. We had a first one in January. A second one followed relatively quickly. A set of future dates has been decided on for those bargaining sessions relatively frequently, which I think I'll speak only for my side of the table, if you will, is a good thing. We would like to move this process forward quickly. From my perspective, we're better off to create certainty about where we are and what our what the rules we're operating are. And so I would like to get to a collective bargaining agreement by early summer. That is extremely ambitious. We look simply at what's happened at other institutions. It seldom goes that quickly, but we're Lobos, we're leaders, we can do it. And I'm an optimist. But it's, to me, it's really good that both sides have agreed to a fairly aggressive set of meeting dates and times, and there are a number now set. The provost's faculty unionization webpage has been kind of stripped out, and it will contain sort of information announcements that we believe we can make about the bargaining process. The bargaining process is something that's conducted in confidence, and that's for two reasons. The most important one is it's right, it's respectful, that we have two groups of people trying to come to agreement over sometimes difficult issues. They need to be able to say what they think at the moment, reflect, and change their positions. So I think that's the reason it should be confidential. but also the law says it's confidential, so just that other reason. And so that's just to say that you shouldn't necessarily expect to hear kind of the weekly bargaining position update, but simply know that bargaining and discussion is going on between representatives of the union and representatives of the university. And so that's underway, and that's good. The laboratory period. And so it's typical of labor law in most states, and New Mexico is no different. When the election was certified, and certainly when we move into the collective bargaining process, we move into what the legal folks call the laboratory period, which is the period of time when we are bargaining in good faith over compensation, benefits, the terms and conditions of employment. That's what the law says we're negotiating over. And so during that period, the university is not supposed to make changes in policies, changes in practices that impact the terms and conditions of employment. So we're not supposed to be kind of unilaterally making changes to the expected teaching loads of faculty, just as an example. Because we're in a period where we're bargaining in good faith over that kind of thing. And so during the laboratory period, we're in this very awkward phase where there may be things we would like to change, policies we'd like to change, practices we'd like to change, but we're limited in our ability to do so. Doesn't mean we can never change. It just means that we're in this period where, because the union represents the faculty, our faculty have voted to have the union their exclusive representative over these matters, these terms and conditions of employment, that we have to respect that. So what, as we look at this, I think when we look at our own policies and procedures, we lump many of them into this book called the Faculty Handbook, much of which is not about faculty, much of which is about other kinds of issues within the university, student discipline, right, academic misconduct. That involves faculty, but it's about our procedures for dealing with student cheats. And so there are things that we think we can work on, and there are things we think that we can't, or that we at least have to talk to the union representatives about changes. And so we are in this period where we may not be able to change some things that are not subject to negotiation or bargaining we can, and we'll have to be explicitly trying to separate those out. And the challenge is that the university administration and the union may not agree on what is something we would bargain on. And so we have to respect that too and be able to have that conversation with the union. Is academic dishonesty something to bargain over? I don't think it is, but I can't tell you that representatives of the union might not think that it is. And if they think it is, then we have to come to some understanding about that. And so we are in this place where if we want to change policies or practices, we're limited in what we can do because we're bargaining in good faith with the union who represents the interests of the faculty in this. So.
Thank you. Any questions for the provost? Liz first.
Yeah, just to follow on that last point, that there are some policies that might be evidently do not fall in the terms and conditions of employment, and the union and the administration might agree on that. Is there any way to formalize in the negotiating process, or it's my suggestion that it be formalized so it can be explicit? Because most of us give a lot of service to working in some way on policy, and it's a kind of frightening prospect to think maybe we hope it's done by summer, but maybe it takes a year. And meanwhile, we have a huge problem with student discipline policies that needs to get wrapped up. So can you offer us the promise of some clarity moving forward? Is that something that could be made clear to the AF&T and the policy committee, for example, that here's what the basic guidelines are of what falls in the freezing of the lab and what is unfrozen in the lab?
All I can offer you is the promise to attempt to bring clarity. I can't promise that there will be clarity today. But the reason I talked to Finney about this today is to start to surface this issue so that we can actually start to explicitly look at the where can we clearly draw the lines or not, because we haven't really started to do that. And again, the I may believe something is not subject to bargaining, the union may, and so at this moment I can't promise clarity, I can only promise to seek it. So I hope that's at least a step. There was another thing.
So what about policies that proceed from the faculty through, like, the Faculty Senate or the AFNT and don't really proceed from the administration? Are they within the purview of the lab or...?
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry.
Was there a question in the back first?
I just want to know, how is the HSC going to be unaffected with these bargaining agreements? How can you ensure that?
That's a big question. Right. So for example, around policies, we could change all kinds of policies right now just for HSC. I don't think that's a good idea, right? Because I think then we're just creating confusion. But we can make changes around those who are not members of the bargaining unit, but I think that particular split would not be a productive or helpful one. We don't want to kind of bifurcate everything. Well, if you're this kind of faculty member, if you're this kind of assistant professor, this is the rule. And if you're this kind of assistant professor, this is the rule. We just create confusion. And so the kind of pause that the laboratory period implies does impact agency. I wish I could say it didn't, but it does.
So, but I just think it's unfair that you just see the vote, and then they're still hearing things that could potentially change their outcome.
I mean, and that, you know, I'll kind of second that, especially with D-175 and 176. We're being hamstrung by that, and that was part of the DOJ bargaining, that those were approved and implemented, and that then DOJ was going to go away, you know, from viewing. And so we're just kind of left in limbo without being able to point to...
Which is why our best, I mean, the absolute best outcome is rapid conclusion of collective bargaining so that we can reestablish certainty and clarity. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's my goal. It's to get us to the end quickly with a good agreement that protects the interests of all of the stakeholders, of our faculty, of our students, of the university, of the state, but get there quickly so we can remove this very awkward period of uncertainty. And slow response to, I think, legitimate needs.
Yeah. A question, given that there is a potential impact on the HSC faculty, do you have advisors who might lean on the impact of particular negotiating positions on the HSC?
That's a different question. That's an excellent question. The answer is yes, but I think you framed it in a way that makes me want to think about it a little bit more. We have people as part of our negotiating team who are certainly very familiar with HSC issues, but I may want to think about that a little bit more. So thank you for raising it as an issue. Because I think that's a little different from questions of just, we can't change some policies yet, but rather what is the sensitivity to other potential impacts on HSC? So thanks for that.
Any other questions?
Other questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is our Faculty Senate Ops Committee reports. Members of the committee, do we have anything? Nancy, I know you have your presentation here in a minute. Did you want to say anything about the...
UNM Day? I can talk briefly about it. Yesterday was UNM Day. It was actually very well attended by faculty, staff, and administrators. Most of the visiting with legislators was done in their offices or outside the Senate or House floors. Just to expound a little bit on what the provost was just talking about, it's super important to know that the funding formula changing, if we get it approved, will ensure that we're hoping for 88%. Let me explain that. When we get a dollar from them for raises for everybody, we really only get 50 cents from them. I know some of you have heard this, so pardon the repetition, but it bears repeating. If we get 88, we'll get 88 cents, which means UNM only has to cough up 12%. I wasn't thrilled about either of those recommendations, right? It was, what did they say, executive 2% at 88%, or LFC had 3% at 70%. So we're still pushing hard in the CUP, which is the seven major universities, presidents, Council of University Presidents, is aligned to ask for more than that. Now, remember, they have a lot more money at the legislature this year because of oil and gas, but they're also much more concerned with the fact that it's not recurring. So funding formula, compensation, New Mexico for the HSC folks, important to know, we're asking for $6 million for a health equity scholarship, so to provide free med school tuition with the stipend that, or the stipulation, that the students will stay for 4 years afterwards. So that would be tremendously helpful to them. They're also trying to get parity with the other local schools, I mean, institutions throughout the state, that do get funding formula because the med school does not. They're never included in that. So, yeah, there are a lot of reasons on HSC to be concerned, and I heard your one about the union. But to say that I think we have good relationships, the president is well-respected up there by most people. Nobody's perfect. But I think it's going pretty well. Any thoughts, questions? We still have 3 weeks in the session left, so if you have anything to say, let me know. We're still going up weekly to talk about things. Thanks.
Okay. So I have five quick things. We have an abbreviated agenda, as you see today. The first thing that I wanted to talk about is the committee appointments. The council chairs, we will working with the council chairs to do our next round of committee appointments actually now, as opposed to waiting till late in the spring. So, you know, those, if you haven't filled out your committee preference forms, or if you have colleagues who still haven't done that, please encourage them to do that. I'd like to start with that committee somewhere in the first week of February, hopefully have those committees set up, or the bulk of them set up before, you know, we get to spring break. The second thing is about IPRA and policies, et cetera. And, you know, I don't want to provide too much context for this, but some of you will remember that in the fall, you know, I had some concern. We all, I think, have a shared concern about what the implications are for this year's interpretation of IPRA. We are now coming into that moment in our academic calendars where we're reviewing graduate students for admissions for the coming year. We're doing third year, gearing up for some of us to look at our colleagues and have some really hard discussions about personnel decisions in our departments, in our colleges. And now is that time of the year where we're taking those notes in meetings, talking about making, like as the provost said, I thought a good way to talk about that is, you know, being able to disagree, to go back, think about something, be able to state your opinion honestly, change your mind. But to have all of that deliberation potentially IPRA-able and people can see all of that, I think is problematic. And I don't think that, you know, we always want to remain in compliance with Open Meetings Act and with IPRA. We're not trying to get around those laws. I know that some of our colleagues have approached me and said, we don't want the Faculty Senate, you know, taking a position that we somehow don't want to comply with these important laws that provide transparency in our state. I don't want us to do that, but I do think that people should at least know and have clear guidance from the Attorney General, clear guidance from University Council about what of their conversations is confidential and what isn't. One clear example that I'm very concerned about has to do with our research. So for those of us who are conducting research and there are subjects involved, and part of our discourse with those subjects is that what we talk about during our interviews or what have you is confidential. Theoretically, as the law is being read right now, you cannot say that. I mean, you can say it, but it won't necessarily be true. That brings us to an ethical dilemma. If we know for a fact that we cannot guarantee confidentiality to our subjects, how can we, as faculty members, ethically make that claim? So this is something that I'm really surprised that we haven't had any feedback from our university council, clear guidance about this. So I'm in the middle of drafting a nasty gram to that effect, asking for clarity from this. I don't believe that it is a smart position to take that we will cope with problems that arise from this when they arise. I think we need to head those off before we get there. So that letter, there's some colleagues who are helping me think through that, work through that, from the policy committee and other concerned colleagues. And we'll have that in front of the university council, copied to the provost, copied to the president, from the faculty senate, asking, you know, seriously, come on, give us some guidance here. And once we get that guidance, I think it's incumbent upon us to then share that guidance back with our colleagues. I'm also concerned about D-170, 175, and 176, and how they are hung up in, not in the president's office. I think there's a misperception that it's sitting on the president's desk. That's not wholly true. Those policies are now in university council, and the president is waiting for whatever it is that university council will do. I think that, in my opinion, it's not my fact, but in my opinion, is that because we are in the collective bargaining stage of this, that they are simply sitting on those kinds of policies, simply because they don't want later on for the union to say, oh, you changed policy in the middle of the negotiations. And so it doesn't matter what the policy is, it's whether the administration changed policies during this period. There are three categories, I think the provost is right on this, of policies in that handbook. One that is clearly has no relation to terms of employment or conditions of employment. Another group that clearly is. I mean, and they're mixed, they're sprinkled in through, A, B, C, D in the faculty handbook. And then there is a gray area, those policies that maybe they aren't. We need to find out from university council or whoever needs to make that determination where precisely. If we have to go line by line, then that's what we have to do. But I think we need to know which of our policies. Our policy committee is hamstrung. We have the Section B task force that's doing great work. That work is pretty much in hiatus until we get this guidance. So I'm concerned about that. And I know that some of you are also concerned. I want you to know that I'm concerned, and we're taking action on that. We'll move forward that as quickly as we can. I'm going to skip over. I don't want to say any more about Section B task force at this point. I've been in conversation with the provost about RAC funding. And for those of you, you know that we had about, I don't know, maybe 100,000 or so and that per semester. And that money was cut back. I think Richwood cut some of it back and some other folk back to about 75,000. And so what we're trying to do is to, one, get us back to that $100,000 threshold per semester, but also to get some guarantees budget-wise that that's not going to decrease again, right? There might be an opportunity. I think I can say talk about this. Kennedy, the reserves, is that premature? Okay. So we think that over in this next year that we'll be able to maintain that level by using reserves for that we have built up in that pool to get us to that 100,000 threshold and then maintain that permanently going forward. And the provost is very interested in doing that. One of the things that we're also thinking about, and this is where it would be really nice if you could jot me an email or if you don't feel comfortable sending it to me, maybe one of our other colleagues, that we would actually start thinking about, this expanding that pool so that there are designations for people who are in the fine arts, the liberal arts, who often don't seem, at least, to get the same level or the type of support in that process. I also, as some of you know, am very interested in supporting our junior faculty, that we would reserve some of those resources for specifically for junior faculty who have not yet made it to third year review. That those resources would be for them early on in their career. And when I first arrived here at UNM, I put in for a RAC grant. They didn't tell me I didn't get it. I mean, I had to see someone else. Well, I got a RAC grant. I'm like, eh. And so that turned me off to the process. I never wanted to reapply because I was like, this, I don't even get feedback as to why you didn't fund my brilliant proposal. So I want us to make sure that we do as much as we can so that when people, they first arrive on our campus, junior faculty, that the first thing that they hear from us in terms of supporting their research isn't no, right? So I've been working on that, and I'd love your thought, your thoughts and your feedback on that. Does that seem like a reasonable thing to do? It's something that if we did change it, it would come through the Faculty Senate. We'd have to vote on that kind of a change, I think. But I'd love your ideas and your feedback on that.
They do have priority, though. The junior faculty is the first thing that they consider in that.
Right, right. So the priorities as opposed to...
You're saying set aside only.
Yeah, a set aside for them, which I think means it increases the amount of support that we have for all of our faculty. You know, so that's what I'd like to do. We're asking for $10,000 in discretionary funds for the Faculty Senate so that we as a collective body, if there was something that we wanted to do, whether that's a speaker series, my pet project going to the Grand Canyon. Anybody interested in going? I'd love to go. You'll go with me?
Absolutely.
I think we need to get in a bus. We have some brilliant experts on the Grand Canyon. I mean, like, really, the world's experts on that remarkable hole in the earth, right? If we could get some of us together to go, and I'd like to invite our new faculty on campus to come, too. So anybody else?
That sounds interested? Impressive. Yeah.
See, there's... All right. Great. There's a lot of folks. All right. But this money would allow us to do, you know, provide some subvention for those kinds of things. All right.
Can we ensure that the emergency medical faculty is part of the group?
Yes, I was just thinking. We don't need you, we need EMS.
With our discretionary funds.
I would love to do that. Right. All right. So the next item on our agenda is our consent agenda. Unless there are questions and comments about
Make a comment. So I think everybody here is a little perplexed about the union bargaining process, and that we are, I think, a little concerned that perhaps we're not being represented. It's certainly not the HSC, which we thought we were out of the, you know, it wasn't going to affect us. It turns out it is. But also, like Liz was saying, for the policy issue. So do we know what makes up that bargaining unit, and do we know that we're represented there? Like, who is making the decisions on the back and forth about what we're going to give away, what we're going to keep?
So there's a bunch of representatives. We have their names, and since everybody who's faculty, and probably anybody on the Senate would be, but not HSC, we get emails about that, asking for people to meet or send ideas or participate in discussing things. And I think one of the best ways to assure that some of the... Okay, so we can ask the provost to get clarity on which parts of the handbook can be changed and which cannot. We can also, as represented by the bargaining unit, I can go in and say, hey, I would like to get clarity. You know, let's agree real quick, because that is stalling a lot of the things that the faculty want to be able to do. Can we prioritize that and get it out of, you know, this is things that we are going to bargain about, and these are things that are going to be left out, so changes can happen. We can affect that as members of the bargaining unit, those of us who are.
I'm really encouraged by some of the outreach efforts from people who are involved in the union. Hopefully in the coming weeks, get a chance to meet with some of the people who are part of that organizing effort, part of the union, to, you know, work and talk about what it is and how we get representation. My goal is, and hopefully they'll, you know, be amenable to this, is that the next time that we are together as a body, hopefully we can ask, you know, someone from that group to come and maybe give us an update as to where we are at our next faculty senate meeting. But this is going to take building a relationship, and I'm committed to doing everything I can to help make that happen. I completely hear the concerns from HSC and the impact that this might have on the faculty handbook and the like. It is far more complex than I thought even 2-3 months ago, and I thought that I had my head wrapped around it. I was completely wrong. This is a very complex set of negotiations. The implications for HSC are undeniable. As much as we might want to imagine that there won't be any implications for HSC, and I 3 months ago thought maybe that wouldn't be the case, HSC wouldn't be impacted much by this. But you know, I share your concerns, and we're going to do everything that we can to get as much information, as much clarity, to build a relationship with those bargaining units so that we can share back to our colleagues what's going on as much as we can. But it's going to take some time. We're going to have to build that relationship. It's not just going to spring up by itself.
Well, again, I insist that, you know, we are the union. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're building a relationship with ourselves and our representatives, and the best way to do this is to actually show up and provide input. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So if we could share that information or, what, you know, just direct everybody where that information is, that would be great.
Well, I find myself getting a lot of information from the union webpage. I mean, you can drill down on some things there. There's some useful information there, but sometimes even the things that are, you know, seem to be clear cut, you still need interpretation sometimes of that stuff. And that's, you know, I read through some of the bylaws and other things for the union. I still had questions, and I was fortunate enough to have some of my colleagues there help me through. I thought I saw someone else's hand a second ago. Yes, sir.
It's hard for me to wrap my head around to say HSC doesn't get a part of it, be a part of that union, but the union still can make decisions reflecting HSC. It's really hard for me to wrap my head around that and say that we didn't get a vote originally because we would have, we didn't want it, but we're still going to go around you and give it to you.
Well, and that's, you know, I brought this up at the last council meeting. I mean, we've been given permission to work with third-party outside counsel to advise us, you know, on how we navigate these waters. So that's, you know, what we're trying to do, too.
So I have a practical question. When AF&T issue came up and for an health science as a faculty member,
right,
how does it go?
It goes to AF&T. AF&T doesn't. No.
I think we should clarify that what's being discussed is the laboratory period is an evolving discussion that the provost said, you know, needs to be carried out in conversation between the union and the administrative representatives in the bargaining process. That's about how policies and what policies can change.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The faculty handbook is still our governing document.
Right, right. Exactly right.
All of our systems of faculty government, you know, dictated by the authority of the regents. So those are two different things,
yeah.
And I'm not sure I understand what the immediate impact of HSC
right.
is on this evolving bargaining agreement of these two bargaining units. But I think we're all a bit perplexed because it's also true that the confidential nature of the bargaining process is going to leave us on our heels for a little while. Insofar as neither side can divulge exactly what is at stake in the bargaining. So I think there are a couple of things that might be getting lumped together here, but the faculty handbook is the faculty handbook. It's a question of whether our existing processes to change things relevant to faculty employment can go forward or will be stopped by the union or by administrative representatives who think it should be frozen.
Yeah.
I think those are two different things.
They are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, I think for, and I don't want to speak for the HSC, there are plenty of folk here who can do that. I think the concern is it's the not knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the,
I'm
it's,
with you.
Yeah,
right.
And so
right.
I completely hear that.
Right.
And as much as I want to say, oh no, the faculty handbook is always going to be the thing, and
we don't know.
We at the end of the day, we don't know everything that we need to know just yet, and it's difficult becoming comfortable with that level of uncertainty.
Right, sure.
And so I hear our colleagues from HSC on that. I think the most and the best that we can do, at least now, is to do exactly what I said: work on the relationship, have as much transparency as we can, get people who are from both sides, who are sitting on both sides of that table, to be able to sit and talk to us about and answer our questions, and hopefully in this forum. I think that's one piece of that. But also, I think for HSC, not to dismiss the concerns, and I think earlier last fall, I was, I think, a bit more dismissive of those concerns than I probably should have been, because I thought the exact same thing, that, you know, I've been told that it was going to be this and it was going, but it's just not necessarily true. The things that I've thought were true about this laboratory period, for example, turn out they may not. I don't know what the legal provenance is for that, and I've asked for that, and I've been told that, oh, we're going to provide that for you, because I've looked, and I have not been able, me personally, to find something that says that your faculty handbook during this process has to be frozen in any way. I don't see that, and you know, unless university council can provide something to the contrary, we're going to continue to agitate for our policies to move forward, the work in Task Force B to continue, et cetera, because I don't see anything that says we must, by law, stop doing what it is that we're doing in faculty governance. So I want to respect our time and move forward in our agenda. Our next item, we're about 20 minutes behind, is our consent agenda. And if we can put that up, I know that we had a number of things that from HSC that we just didn't get the information in time last Friday to put those items on the agenda for this week. Some of you will remember last fall when I was talking about whether we are or we are not subject to the Open Meetings Act, right? And I would have loved to have had 10 or 15 more minutes on Friday to add those agenda items. But as it stands right now, we are in strict compliance with that, and that's why those agenda items didn't make it on. So I apologize. I know you all from the HSC side of the house worked hard to get those things through the process, but we just didn't get the information that we needed in time. But I assure you the very next faculty senate meeting that we have, we'll have those things on the docket. Our consent agenda item, our consent agenda. Are those the only two things there? All right. Just called straight for the vote. Right?
Is there any discussion?
Yeah, there. But I just asked that. I think. Any comments on what we have on this the consent agenda? Yes.
I actually have a question. Is this based on, for example, openings? You know, every fall there is a call for which committees would you like to be on? Is this part of that same thing that comes out in the fall where they look for, they ask for people who wants to serve on which committee, like do you want to be on the UNM Press Board?
Right, we're filling vacancies on committees, and these are specific areas of interest. So let's say you had wanted to be on this. That person, for instance, is from music. That person's from biology. So they may have had a specific need to fill a specific area.
Because every year, we fill out that survey.
You're about to do it again.
Every year, we hear radio silence. We're never asked to be on any of those committees.
Who's we? Do you speak for everyone?
Branch folks.
Oh, we call branch people all the time.
There are a lot of
branch people on them.
For 4 years now.
Yeah. It could be seriously that someone's in that one. Yeah, sorry.
So last year, if you check your email, you'll find that from me that I did actually send an email back out to people saying, this is the number of slots that we had. Thanks, everyone. We have far more people who were interested than we actually had slots. And one of the reasons that I sent that email is because when I first came here, I did the same thing, filled out the never heard back. Mm-hmm. So I never wanted to have that same experience. So I did actually send an email about that. I'm not being defensive about it. I'm just saying that email is out there. What we're doing is we're changing that process so that we do get that done a bit earlier. And we actually do ask branch campus members to participate. In fact, the most difficult slots to fill often are the branch campus slots. So we do ask for a lot of branch. And if you go actually out on the Faculty Senate website, I don't want to speak too much out of turn, but I think most of the committees actually have representation from a lot of them have representation from the branch campuses, but it isn't great. Some of it has to do with, literally, it says, this committee, you need one representative from this college, one representative from this college, one from the College of, you know, Nursing, one from this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So some of it is prescribed. I tried to spread out the number as evenly as I could across North Campus, Main Campus, and the branch campuses in terms of percentages. I also try to control as much as I can if when I can. If it's Pat, I don't know if it's, you know, the gender thing, it can get confusing, but I try to also control for, try to have some gender balance as well on our committees. This spring, we're going to do a different process. Our council chairs will get together, and we're going to literally do it like the fantasy draft, right? So, it's true. When you only have two faculty members from the College of Nursing who filled out, or these smaller academic units, you have to be careful that not two or three different committees want that person. And then you don't want to, you know, we have rules about how many committees a person can serve on. So, did I say that correctly? How many committees a person can serve on? Right. Yeah, so it's a complex process. We're trying to simplify it. I'll always shine as much light on as I can. I assure you that if it feels that way, it's not intended that way. And I will send more than one email to make sure that our branch campus folks know where we are. Yes, ma'am.
Are they 2-year appointments? Because I'm on, like, the IT committee, and, you know, we're looking at changing our platform and that sort of thing, and you can't kind of just change people in the middle of that.
Right. Just start over. Well, it depends on the committee. Some are 2-year appointments. Some are 3-year appointments. So it depends on which committee or council. What we, you know, try to do if we have people who've come off is get someone from that same academic unit or that area of expertise and put them on for the remainder of that person's term. And then usually if that person wants to continue, say they fill out 6 months of someone's term or a year, we'll give them priority if they wanted to continue on a committee like that. You're welcome. Any other questions about that process? So, I'm sorry. Yeah. So all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The ayes have it. So the consent agenda passes. So whenever you have that, once we bring that there and I ask for the comment, then we can go straight. Don't we get motion for it? Okay. All right. The next item is it's number 6. Again, we've done Senate committee appointments.
We're on
number 6. We had Dr. Nancy Lopez. Is Corinne? I didn't see her.
So only two of our co-chairs are here. So I'll introduce Veronica Asalte, who is the Census Partner Specialist, and we are here because we need your help as trusted messengers on the urgency of a complete count for the 2020 census. And we wanted to provide you with some basic information and answer any questions that you might have, but also think about ideas and strategies. So I'll introduce, this is Tabitha King, who is one of the co-chairs of the Complete Count Committee here on campus, and then Veronica Astate. So I was hoping that Veronica could start, because she's actually employed at the census and can give us a brief overview. You also have a handout that we provided with the attachments to the agenda that includes this postcard. There were like 10 different flyers on there, but we urge you to use this as talking points in your classes so that we can really convey the urgency and why the census matters. It's only once every 10 years. So I'll turn it over to Veronica and then Tabitha, and then we'll open up for questions.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for having us here. As you might have heard already, we are already launching the National Census 2020 campaign. You're going to start seeing a lot of advertisement on TV, the radio, billboards. But if we don't message, especially the students and the younger adults from the grassroots down, you know, we can be seeing all the mass media campaign we want, but if they don't know why is it important and how does it work, They're not going to participate. They're not going to be counted. This is a once-in-a-decade opportunity, so it is crucial that we count everybody. And this is going to be the very first time that the census is going to be available online. Starting on March 12th, we're all going to be receiving a postcard in the mail that will contain a postcard with the website that goes live March 12th. There's also going to be a 1-800 number that people can call. And the website and the phone line are going to be available in 12 different languages. The bar menu on the website is going to be very, very clear, where it will indicate the 12 options, and then the person can go and select the language that they feel most comfortable, and then do the questionnaire in that language. In addition to those 12 languages, we're going to have 59 language assistance videos and instructions for people to do it online or over the phone. Like I said, we want to make sure that people know where they can go and access technology if they don't have access to a computer or Wi-Fi. So we're encouraging the Complete Count Committee here at UNM and CNM to create events where we will have laptops or a tablet available and invite people to come and get the questionnaire done those specific days. Also for students who live in the dormitories, we're going to have a special task with the census employees, and that's called group quarters enumerations. So we already have been working with the facility managers to make sure that we go in February and then count everybody that is on the dormitories. But, you know, we also have a lot of people who are around campus, apartments. Even if it's like 12 students in one apartment, we need to make sure that they know it's safe to put everybody. They don't need to just put the ones that are allowed to stay in the apartment. We don't share the information with any other agency. It's just confidential. What we share at the end is the statistical demographic information. How many people live in this community, their ethnicity, whether they're male or female. That's the information that becomes available for public knowledge, but the names and specifics, that doesn't, it's kept confidential and it's protected by law. So.
And just moving on to the flyer that everyone has, and just because of time and we don't want to be redundant, just want to go over some of the key points. I think when I was younger, and even as a college student, I would have thought that the census was just something political, something that I didn't need to be involved with, something that didn't directly affect me. But just in letting our students know that this isn't just a survey that's going out that the government might want you to participate in, but that it directly affects number two in the funds that we get. For every New Mexican that's not counted, that's $3,745 that we're losing out per year. So you can imagine what that would accumulate to over 10 years. And then also starting March 12th, that's when, again, as Veronica said, that the survey will go live. But even before then, just us educating our students about the direct impacts of what this would mean. Funding, growing up in New Mexico, being a native of New Mexico, if I can use that word, and just seeing the differential funding between living in Alamogordo compared to living in Albuquerque, and how not understanding those differences, not understanding those differences to access. And then also because of the state that we live in, and the way that we want to help our undocumented citizens, that there won't be a citizenship question, but it will, by not participating, you won't be seen. You won't have those resources. Your experience here in the state won't change. So that's just what I wanted to bring to you guys, and just a short overview and how disseminating this information could help our students be more engaged.
So the one last thing I'll add is that all efforts end sometime in July. So if we get these numbers wrong, we will have to live with them for a decade. Mm-hmm. And so it is incredibly urgent. one quick question, and then we're going to open it up, that Finney just asked is, well, the students in the dorms, do they have to fill out anything? They're part of group quarters, so they technically don't, even local village, but it's incredibly important for them to know that anyone else, say you have cousins or whoever is living nearby that is not being counted, the unit of analysis is the dwelling, right? So you might have Theo and Thea and a mixed status family. Everyone needs to be counted. Children are often undercounted. So are college students, because they might be couch surfing. They're homeless students. All of these things matter. So what I want you to think about is, number one, questions that you might have, but also how will you, as a trusted messenger, especially on that last point about the citizenship question of being there, emphasize that in your class. I want to repeat this message until the end of the semester. And how will you co-brand? The other undercount that seldom you hear about is good census data on race. So we know that that data is used to understand, if you show up at the door to look for an apartment, are you going to be discriminated based on what you look like? I call that street race. If you're walking down the street, what race? So Obama just checked one box, and there was a reason for that, because when you check multiple boxes, say all of us take a DNA test and find out we have ancestors that walked all over the earth, then you have data that does not help you necessarily understand the color line and how it operates, the voting rights, housing, et cetera, et cetera. So those are two other counts that are often not talked about. I did write a piece in theconversation.com called How the Census Bureau Keeps Confusing Race and Ethnicity that kind of synthesizes why it's so important not to confuse race and ethnicity. They're not the same thing. It's not the same as nationality or language. But I saw a hand here, and then I'll go back to Finn.
So I was just wondering so a lot of our students are not residents of New Mexico. Could you just say how that works?
Sure. So the most important thing is, where do they spend the majority of their time? Even if they're in study abroad, the majority of the time they spend in New Mexico, their state. So if they're in the group quarters, they're already counted.
Okay.
Their parents should not be counting them twice,
okay,
right? But if they are in a study abroad and they actually are here most of the time, they should be counted here.
Okay, so it's like, even if they can't vote here, they're still counted here.
They spend the majority of their time here?
So yes, absolutely. It's wherever they're spending the majority of the time. So regardless of their registration to vote, they need to be counted here.
Okay, thank you.
So, Nancy, the majority of the time is not the tenure period then. So if a student comes to me for three semesters or one semester, that's a very small portion of 10 years, but they're still taking this? They're still checking?
Yes, because that's where they're residing during the decennial.
Just
count.
When it happens to happen, okay.
Yes.
So, Nancy,
my question had to do with the interface between our students and people who are, you know, taking the census, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people who are going around with the clipboards or whatever it is that they're doing. So, are those people entering into our dorms or anything like that?
Quarters.
Yeah.
Well, we're not worried about an undercount for group quarters. We have those numbers. That's not
okay.
The worry. The worry is the other students, right? The ones who are living with a friend or don't realize that because they are here, they need to count themselves as living here, even though their family might be in Gallup, right? So that's the undercount we're most worried about. The dorms we're not really worried about. They are part of group quarters.
Yes, and in regards to people going door-to-door, you're only going to get the visit of a census worker if you have not filled the questionnaire online or over the phone, or by default reminder, you will receive the traditional paper form, but you still need to fill it out and mail it back. If you don't, starting mid-May, we're going to send census workers, but we don't want to encourage people to wait until that, because a lot of people will be like, well, is this a census worker? Who is this? Don't open the door. Don't participate. So it's better if we encourage that self-participation early in the operation.
And we meet our UNM Complete Count Committee, which consists of four co-chairs. We have two student, well, former student, and Kieran Katira, who couldn't be here today, every other 2 weeks on Wednesday in room 260 UAEC, the University of Library Management Center. So we invite you to join us. We need a lot of help. There's a lot of fear out there. We know that every person we miss is going to be damaging for our state, right, for our future. So our next meeting is tomorrow. It's at 9 a.m. always. And I wanted to think about ways and strategies that you could use in your class. Maybe just using these bullets to have 5 minutes to have students think and talk about the census. We're having our second press conference. There's one already available that's been recorded on race.unm.edu. where you can look at sound bites that we created with 20 speakers, different languages, on the urgency of a complete count. But what can you do in your classes to dedicate some time on this? The idea is that if we repeat this at least 7 times, maybe students will do it. The beauty is that you don't even have to have that postcard of the census that sends you. You can fill it out with just knowing your address or cross streets. So the idea is co-brand your events, use the census logo, share these materials, the ones that were attached to the agenda. HSC, we presented last week, and thank you, Brandy, for inviting us, and they actually invited us again to share what they came up with. One of the faculty members says we're going to set up a kiosk because they see patients, and these are the vulnerable communities that are most likely to be undercounted. So think about ideas, and I hope, Finney, we can come back and hear and share some of those ideas, because from here until July, if we don't get it right, we live with these numbers.
I'm from the libraries, and that's, you mentioned like tablets and computers. We have, like in Zimmerman, we often set up kiosks, or like whenever there's like voting going on, we set up like a little display like about the different campus voting. And it's just a high traffic area. There's a lot of people that come through there, and we always have public computers. So I'm just floating that. This would be like a great educational opportunity, and we might could get a lot of people.
Yes, yes, let's team up, because that's going to be a wonderful resource. But we just need to let the students know, you know, like that's where they can go and get it done.
Sure.
So,
and you have a flyer for the census is hiring. I mean, it's a massive hiring effort, and it's perfect because it's flexible hours. So send that flyer out if you can. Learn whatever you use.
It'd be nice to have that representation on the branch campuses.
We need complete count committees in every campus. CNM is ahead of us. They have a tab on their website that says 2020 census. We need to get there so that people will see that branding, that co-branding, and it just becomes a familiar thing.
And when can you start? Am I missing? When can you
start? March 12th. It's on the postcard.
Yeah,
so that was part of your
date.
March 12th.
Yeah, it's in blue. Maybe it's not visible. Again, we don't have any funding. We're doing this volunteer, so copies are whatever we can in my department, right? Or in our department, so we don't have color copies. But yes, it's March 12th. And it ends sometime in July. That's it.
Yes.
Okay. Any questions?
Just quick, are there big posters that we could use to make some of the displays in the library? Are there larger posters than just these? How would we get
Well, this is what our Complete Count Committee came up with. Feel free to use it and blow it up. But you can be creative, one that is speaking to the communities that you work in.
But there isn't an official, big one that's on the Fed site or something.
Yes, we do have on the census.gov, there's a partner resource, and it has a lot of PDFs with visuals and graphics, the logo. You can just print some of those or use some of the visuals to create your own.
Great, thank you.
Okay.
The last thing I'm going to say, because we didn't repeat it, is the confidentiality. A lot of people are scared. Just keep in mind that share this information, and if you do share confidential information, you face 5 years in jail and a $250,000 fine. And, of course, the data cannot become publicly available for 72 years. So just emphasizing, do you want someone knocking on your door for those communities that may be scared, or do you want to fill it out as quickly as possible so no one comes? And keep in mind, it is confidential. It is punishable by law and reveal any of this information. So emphasizing that, because we know people are scared, even if they have papers, because they may be in a mixed status family, right?
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
And I'm going to leave these brochures here. Whoever wants to come and get some, it talks about the 4 different ways in which you can fill your census questionnaire.
Thank you all for that. Thank you very much. Our next agenda item is public comment. Do we have any public comment? Daily Lobo's not here. No comment. Senator comments? Yes.
Can I just make 2 quick announcements that I think are kind of high level? Does everybody know you can vote on the seal online between now and February 7th? There's also a comment box if you want to like really push for one of them. We were more or less branded against our will some years ago, and this is a chance for us to influence the selection of the seal. The second is that February 6th at the sub, there's a major Department of the Navy and OEO conference on sexual assault and prevention that will be all day. You can sign up online if you are interested in the plenaries or the breakout sessions, or you can just pop into the breakout sessions. So I urge you to look at the president's website for a link to this really important conference that OAO is co-sponsoring.
Okay.
And I'll just piggyback the seal thing. It's actually on the door next to the bathroom right outside the door if anybody needs to see the seal. There's a poster.
So I have one, unless someone has anything else, I have one last announcement. Okay.
Just a question about the process for elections and nominations, because I believe that's coming up next month, correct? Mm-hmm. So just to put the word out that and I don't want to speak out of turn. I think, Rick, you might know the dates when those nominations might be due.
The nominations from?
For faculty governance.
February 20th.
Right. So just putting the word out, because it is hard to get people to volunteer to vote. I just wanted to remind people that that's coming up pretty quick.
And there'll be communications about that from the university.
We've sent one out, and we'll continue to send reminders.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So I have one last thing. I don't know how many jazz enthusiasts I have in the room. This is the 100th anniversary of the Harlem Renaissance this year, and depending on who you ask. And after about a year of working on this, we have managed to get the Langston Hughes Project is going to actually appear on our campus, and they're going to be here for 3 days in February. So from the 20th through the 22nd, they'll be in Albuquerque. On campus, there'll be master lectures about jazz and about the Harlem Renaissance. We have a Pope Joy event where we'll have a free concert for the academic community, and it's Ron McCurdy out of USC. You're nodding your head, you probably know who I'm talking about. He's a fantastic musician. Rodney Bowe, who's on our campus, will be part of that trio. It's a really incredible honor for him. They'll present that. It'll be at 10:30 in the morning, like on Friday. There'll be posters and stuff like that, you know, coming out for you. But also on Friday or on Saturday, that on the 22nd, there'll be a benefit concert for scholarships on our campus at the Outpost. So it's a concert there. So look to that. I'm really proud that we were able to pull that off, to get them here, and the different academic units who chipped in for that, very, very appreciative that we're able to get that done. We are adjourned. See you all next month.
Early. It's
early. We made it early.